You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the closing session for day one, PeaceCon. So, the Global Fragility Act, and you know, some of those important meetings happening up at the UN in a week or so. George this morning said, this afternoon, the GFA is a landmark peace-building, conflict prevention law. That was huge. It was huge, a big win for our field, and there was so much excitement, and yes, we were all very excited. But it was going to be a long slog to implement this. And the folks here have been our partners. We don't always agree on the how, but we always agree on the what, that we need to center and prioritize peace building and conflict prevention. And it has been a true partnership. I am so excited that I don't have to talk about the GFA today. Nobody wants to hear what I have to say about it anymore. But the best part is my dear friend, Joseph Sani, who is a vice president here at USIP and an expert beyond expert in peace building in coastal West Africa. So he's the perfect person to be talking about this. Thank you.
Thank you, Liz.
And for our audience around the world and participants in this room, welcome to the closing plenary of to the session on the Global Fragility Act and the associated strategy, which is the U.S. strategy for preventing conflict and promoting stability, mainly in West Africa. As many of you know, the Global Fragility Act represents a paradigm shift, a shift on the way the United States addresses or responds to conflict. There is a focus on locally driven solutions, a focus on inclusive partnerships or burden sharing. There is a focus on learning, and most importantly, on a long-term view. Because, of course, prevention or stabilization do not happen overnight. And it has been over a year since the submission of 10-year plans for each GFA country. And today, I think it's an opportunity for us to hear from the most senior policymakers and implementers of that act in the US administration. The panelists will share insights from the implementations. They will dive into some of the challenges, opportunities, and the missed opportunities. They will also help us understand maybe the way forward, some of the reforms that may be needed, what Congress will have to do, or what the local partners themselves will have to do, or people in this room, what we will have to do to move the ball forward. So I'm very excited to have with us this distinguished panelist. I will start I have my friend, Anna Wilkowski, who is also the Assistant Secretary of Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operation in the U.S. State Department. Joe McMenamin, the Principal Director in the Office of the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Counter-Narcotics and Stabilization Policy, U.S. Department of Defense. Brittany Brown, Acting Assistant to the Administrator, Bureau of Conflict Prevention and Stabilization, and Michelle Sisson, who is Assistant Secretary, Bureau of International Organization Affairs in the U.S. Department of State. Michelle will bring in the perspective of the international organizations, the UN, and as you know, UNGA is 2 weeks from now, I believe, and we have the future, the summit of the future. It will be an interesting conversation, and we hope, Michelle, you will enrich this discussion by bringing us the world on stage. So I'm looking forward to that. As a way to introduce yourself and your department, I think I thought we would start by helping the audience understand the positionality of your agency or what you do in regard to the GFA. So my first question to you all, I will start with Anne, is what's the role of CSO when it comes to the GFA?
Thank you. It's so great to be here. Let me just start by saying, stepping back, that what the GFA is meant to do is to mandate that the US government take a more integrated, focused, and evidence-based approach to preventing and mitigating violent conflicts. And I think it's worth underscoring from our perspective that doing so is more important than ever. As you've already heard today, and we all know, the world is experiencing more protracted and spreading violent conflict with significant attendant human and humanitarian consequences. And as Ambassador Moose said this morning in the opening session, in challenges there are opportunities. So what do we do? The State Department leads implementation of the Global Fragility Act and its associated strategy. And the bureau that I lead, CSO, holds the day-to-day responsibility for that implementation within the State Department and is the implementation lead within the US government. We are working closely with our terrific partners across the interagency, DOD here and USAID, and there are others with whom we work closely who are not here as well, and of course across the State Department, including with my colleague, Assistant Secretary Sisson. Leading GFA implementation is our Bureau's top priority. Let me just, if I may, take a moment to say a couple words about the GFA, what it's doing. It's bringing more resources, it's bringing more attention, it's bringing more intentionality to building peace around the world in a diverse set of places, in Haiti, in Mozambique, in Libya, in Papua New Guinea, in coastal West Africa. And more importantly, as we've already been talking about today, the importance of prevention, it is operationalizing prevention in these places. We're elevating and increasing high-level diplomatic engagement with our partner countries and with international partners, engaging women, young people, groups that the US government and partners may not necessarily always routinely engage. We're piloting new approaches and we're implementing dozens of new programs that we believe can make a difference in all these places. And hopefully, provide new models for other places around the world. We're, as has been said, continue to be guided by principles of learning and adaptation. And that's why it's so important that we're here with all of you. We must continue to engage with this community, to learn from all of you, to work with all of you. Your research and your practical insights are so critical to help us deliver on the promise of the Global Fragility Act. And before I pass the mic, I must offer a special note of gratitude to USIP and to the Alliance for Peacebuilding for your support and for your partnership. Thanks.
Good afternoon. I'm here representing my boss, Jim Sines, who is responsible for the department's implementation of the Global Fragility Act. In that role, we do the oversight of the policy, the activities within the department to either directly or indirectly support the execution of the Global Fragility Act. And doing that, we work with the Joint Staff, the Combatant Commands, our other policy offices, noticeably DASDE Africa, DASDE Western Hemisphere, and the Joint Staff in developing the plans, and in working with our combatant commanders, especially AFRICOM, U.S. Indo-PACOM, and also U.S. Southern Command, to actually implement some of the goals and objectives of the Global Fragility Act in those priority countries. Now, our office, you notice in the name, Counter-Narcotics and Stabilization Policy, and you wonder, that's kind of a weird mix, and if you think that's bad, we also now picked up Counter-Uncrewed Systems Oversight for the Undersecretary of Policy. So it's a very broad portfolio. But what that does give our office and what we are very good at is working with the interagency. We've been working with the interagency in the counter-narcotics programs, the counter-threat finance programs for many years, so we have a knowledge of how to work with the interagency to get things done, how to work with partners in a collaborative effort to push forward key and emerging issues and sustain them and learn from them as we go forward. Another part of our office, though, that also supports the Global Fragility Act is we have the civil affairs portfolio in our activities. So therefore, all those civil affairs teams that go downrange into the Global Fragility Act countries are supporting indirectly the Global Fragility Act by helping build better governance through that civil-military operations and stability operations capabilities. So that's where we stand today.
Hello. All right. You know, it was interesting. I was listening to Liz talk about like sludging through the bureaucracy. And so I was like imagining the team at CPS and the bureau that I lead, like as the sludgers, like sludging through all of this, like slogging through everything that's happening. And you know what? Like I kept just imagining instead, it's like these rays of light coming through that fog that is the bureaucracy. And that is GFA, right? Like GFA is systematically telling us how to implement 3Ds, which we've been talking about for, I don't know, the 20 years I've been in DC, we have been talking about 3Ds. This is making it so that we have to do this. It's the law. So we are being held accountable to doing it. So at USAID, what we're doing is we're talking to people who are out there running programs, who have 20 years of experience and knowledge and lessons, and how are we making the systems actually respond in a way so that all of that interagency work that DOD does and that state does, that we are all doing it together, and it is impacting all the programs and the activities that we're doing on the ground that are impacting these people, they're actually feeling that it is the weight of the whole US government that's trying to tackle these problems.
So I'm up here with my three terrific colleagues from across the US government who work specifically on GFA, but stepping back, I'm responsible for not this bilateral effort of the GFA, but for how the U.S. shows up leading at the United Nations, across the United Nations system, in peace building. And so we obviously know that this is urgent. If we look at the numbers, we've got more than 2 billion people around the world impacted by conflict and current conflict situations, immediate post-conflict, that's a quarter of humanity. So we know it's urgent. The US GFA approach has honed in on several priority areas of the world and countries. The UN peacebuilding efforts actually coincide because a number of the GFA efforts are actually implemented with UN partners. In fact, when I was out in West Africa recently, I was listening to the International Organization for Migration brief on their efforts, and I was like, ah, that is USAID and GFA, but it's also IOM. The UN, and I know we'll talk about this in a little while, of course, as you mentioned, is gearing up for High Level Week in New York, Summit of the Future, but also as we look ahead, this whole architecture, if you look at the peace-building work of the United Nations, is due for another review. So it's been about 19 years since the Peace-Building Commission, the Peace-Building Fund were launched, working in a number of the countries that the GFA is also working in. There's a mediation support unit. There's a new hub for data. So what is the relationship, I think is your question, of what we do in the Bureau of International Organization Affairs? We are leading, as the United States, to push all of these UN efforts. Ambassador Moose, at the opening of today's session, said, you know, is peace-building toolbox, is the peace-building toolbox fit for purpose? Well, we're all working on that, bilaterally as the U.S. and as the U.S. showing up as a member state in the U.N. And the last thing I'm going to say is the UN is not this sort of faceless bureaucracy. I mean, it isn't, but it's all of us, right? It's all of the countries around the world. It's all of the member states. And it's all of you, too, because civil society, academic experts, private sector, local communities, you're part of this conversation. And that's why it's so great to be here today with all of you.
Thank you. And I can't help but notice the excitement when we talk about the GFA, but I'm still missing the meat. Why are we so excited? Do you have reasons to be excited? Can you point out to some successes? So Anne, I will turn to you because, I mean, are there any successes or causes for such an optimism? Because I'm seeing, are we talking about the same thing?
Why are you so skeptical? Okay, so let's just back up for a minute.
You promised us no
batch questions. I know. So a little over a year ago, as Sunny already mentioned, we produced plans with a 10-year time horizon for each of the places where we're working. We have been implementing dozens of new programs that are aligned to the objectives in those plans. Through a fund that has been set up specifically to support the Global Fragility Act Prevention and Stabilization Fund. And we also have catalyzed other programming and aligned other resources, including with the Department of Defense, to our efforts. So that is new. When we travel to some of these places, and I've been to nearly all the GFA countries at this point, through coastal West Africa, Libya, Mozambique, and Papua New Guinea, and in Haiti. One of the things that has really struck me has been the general reception to the approach that we're taking under the GFA. And what I mean by that is the inclusive approach that we're taking, both in terms of the stakeholders and the types of actors that we're reaching to, but also in terms of the way that we're approaching the problem set. That security challenges cannot be resolved through security solutions alone. That they involve exactly the kind of work that this community has been so invested in, building social cohesion, building inclusive economic development, extending the responsiveness of governance. So earlier this year, for example, I was in the north of Mozambique, where we're very focused in the province of Cabo Delgado. I wasn't all the way up there, but in a nearby province. And we had a chance to meet with these young journalists, a lot of women, who were so eager to report and to report and tell their communities about the conflict in Cabo Delgado and the causes of it, with civil society actors who were equally eager to do the same thing. I've been in Cote d'Ivoire meeting with young entrepreneurs who are working in conflict-affected areas, figuring out a way to make their businesses profitable in those very difficult places. And in Papua New Guinea, where women entrepreneurs, small businesses, are working day by day to develop their skills, to get access to markets, to get access to the kind of capital that they need to help them be successful. In all of these places, what I found is that the individuals we're meeting with are so inspiring, and they are reflective of the broader approach that we are mandated to take under the Global Fragility Act. And then let me just say one other thing that's changing, if I might. We really are executing on the ground a whole of government effort. And we're doing that by combining the tools that we have as a government in ways that are really important and really focused. So for example, in Ghana, the government of Ghana has taken important steps to address the historic exclusion of the Fulbe communities
who live primarily on the northern border, working to increase Fulbe participation in political and economic processes. And the reason for that is because it makes them, among other things, or the value of that is it makes them less vulnerable to violent extremist recruitment. Again, looking at Cote d'Ivoire, the government there is taking a community-centered approach to security, increasing trust and collaboration between security forces, the local government, improving early warning systems, working on advancing inclusive economic development, strengthening community policing. And that is particularly important, of course, because of the changes, the many changes we've seen in the Sahel and the threats that are emanating from the Sahel. That is a real prevention case. So I don't want to underestimate the challenges that are associated with this effort and the challenges that we are confronting and our partner countries are confronting globally. But what the GFA has given us an opportunity to do is to approach these challenges in new ways that take the important lessons that we've learned over the last couple of decades, the work that you all have done, to apply it, to learn from it, and to adapt so that we can be as effective as possible in all these places and draw lessons for other parts of the world as well.
Oh, yes. I think... Even just producing the 10-year strategy was already a win. I mean, let's remember, it was 1 year ago. And so in addition to that, being able to implement some of the programs is a massive lift. So that we all, but we also acknowledge the fact that this is a paradigm shift. It's not easy, a paradigm shift. I mean, moving the US administration, you are not moving a small boat, it's a huge boat. So there are some anticipated challenges. So, but because I would like to address that question of challenges to the most enthusiast among us in this room, which is Brittany. So please, do you see, from where you sit, I think as an implementer or someone who supports implementers or our US partners, what have been some of the challenges in the implementation of the GFA?
I think the biggest compliment I maybe am going to get in a long time is that you just called me an implementer. Like, I love that. I'm not a bureaucrat this week, I get to be an implementer with some of the great people in this room. So, no surprise, I want to tell a little story. So, everyone, come with me. Over the last 10 years or so, I couldn't talk to anyone or travel anywhere in Africa without people talking about the herder-farmer conflicts that are happening in West Africa. And these conflicts have been going on for decades, actually. But we just all really started seeing it rising up to the place where I would hear about it regularly and about the impacts that it was happening. And what we would hear is that they're more deadly, they're more frequent, and they're more widespread across West Africa. So in USAID fashion, we go out and we start trying to figure out, like, what's going on? We start talking to people. Why are there more of these? We hear that it's the instability in the Sahel. It's extreme climactic events. It's changing the way these nomadic farmers or the nomadic herders are interacting with farmers. So we identified an area under a GFA and under this 10-year plan. We went out in northern Cote d'Ivoire and talked to some communities and asked them, what is it going to take to stop these conflicts? And the community came up with one of my favorite things, which is parking lots for cattle. And I first heard this and I was like, what are we talking about, these parking lots for cattle? But it really is like a physical barrier to put cattle in, because we were discovering that, like, overnight or in just a few hours, cows could go in and, like, maybe cattle cows, I'm not the farmer, I'm not the herder, whatever the difference is, the cows could go in and just destroy someone's livelihood. So of course it's going to lead to conflict. So we go to the community, we say, what's going to actually work to try and fix this? Like, what is going to actually help? And again, the communities had the answer, right? These parking lots. And the thing that is brilliant about the parking lots is the youth in the communities run the parking lots, so they get to collect a very small fee. The women in the community collect the fertilizer from the parking lots, which means now they have fertilizer for their farms. So like everything is working. It is a fantastic program. And the thing that I'm most proud of this is that we went and did an evaluation with our very innovative, interesting monitoring and evaluation that we were doing. And we go out and we look and we see that between 2018 and 2022, they were seeing an average of 50 conflicts a year in this community. And in 2023, there were zero conflicts, zero. So we know that these cattle parking lots were working. Now, for those of you in this room who work on programs, you're going to say, yeah, Brittany, USAID has been doing locally led development forever. Like, what is so unique about this? Like, what does this have to do with GFA? Like, why are you telling us this story of like a brilliant activity that's happening in Northern Cote d'Ivoire? And the reason I'm telling you this is because this is different than all those other locally led development examples that we have of like this awesomeness that USAID does on a daily basis. And the ways that it's different is that because of GFA, we have the ability to layer this program with State Department and DOD in a systematic way. Not just a way because the ambassador gets along with the mission director who gets along with the implementing partner, but it is because the systems are now requiring that we are layering this program. It's different because we have PSF funding, which means that we actually have designated funding that is going to look at issues around fragility. And it's multi-year that we know we're going to have this money again next year. For those of you who do this, you know that that is like our fear. We're always like, are we actually going to be able to do this again next year? Because we don't know what's going to happen in Congress. It's also that we are going to take these lessons and we are going to, again, systematically disseminate all of the lessons we are learning, because we know it's not just Cote d'Ivoire who's dealing with herders and farmers. It is everyone in West Africa. And my guess would be it's probably other places around the world that are also dealing with very similar things. So discover these community solutions that now we are able to get into the system, which is such a huge win. And then the last piece of this that really sticks with me around like why GFA is so important and how we're doing this is that we have reminded the US government what it means to have a 10-year plan and be looking at 10 years out and also be able to look at the urgent. Like we can look at to right now, those 50 conflicts a year that are impacting those communities, and we can look at 10 years out at the same time, and we can do it with these like really incredible results that can go from, you know, in a small community, 50 conflicts a year, like just imagine that in your neighborhood, down to zero. There's like few times when we can feel that in our hearts, and that's something that we're able to do with GFA, and we're gonna start seeing that spread everywhere, and I'm so proud of it. So then the last piece is in West Africa, you mentioned IOM. So we have this incredible thing that we partnered with the Germans on, it's CSSM, Coastal West Africa's stability's in there, security's in there, mechanism is in there. Sorry, acronyms are not my strength. We have this like amazing thing where the two people who are managing this program in West Africa are sitting right next to each other, and one's a German, and one's a US government employee, and then IOM is running it. Like, this is the dream. The funding is shared with multiple donors. It's run by a UN organization, and we are doing community development that is feeding back into this incredible system so that we can layer that DOD, the DOD work, and the State Department work, and we can layer the diplomats, and we can layer our, you know, our military attachés, and it is all part of this system that now we are showing people that 3Ds is not just a dream. It is actually something that we are living. And if you can do it in coastal West Africa, trust me, you can do it anywhere.
We leave the dream, huh? So let me ask you this again. I think it was a mistake to ask an enthusiast to identify challenges. So I will come back to the question again. But seriously, are there any areas of in need of improvement as we move forward with the GFA? Is it that perfect? What can we do more to facilitate this kind of thing, or at least replicate the coastal West Africa experience elsewhere? Is it easily transferable? So Joe, will you want?
All right. I thought I was going to be answering cultural differences here at the moment, but you know, there's a lot of things that can be done. One is, you know, how do we work within systems? You know, and mentioned already that organizing a DOD system, a state system, and a USAID system to get a positive result is a good effort. How do we do it? How do we work through that? How do we look and the capabilities required in the future for coastal West Africa, Mozambique, Libya, places like that. Budget cycles don't always follow good ideas. So 10-year plans are great, but we have to put money and budgets toward 10-year plans to get us to the objectives or the waypoints to move down to find ourselves with success in these GFA countries. You know, and how do we work in the budget system? You know, DOD, like everybody else up here, we get a 1-year budget. Sometimes it's a 6-month budget, depending on when we get a CR or get a budget passed, but you get a 1-year budget. So a good idea that gets funded for 1 year, you're constantly fighting to get funding in the out years to support a 10-year plan. So how do you go to Congress and convince them that what we're doing is important? And we all have committees. The committees for state are different than the committees for DOD, and then you throw in a few other outliers out there who have different ideas of what you should do. So how do you work with partners? How do you work with Congress? How do you work and integrate military objectives into GFA objectives, military objectives for stabilization? As we all know, everybody reads the Department of Defense strategies and all like that, that China is the pacing threat for DOD. But how do we increase stability, and let's just say in Africa, to counter Chinese influence through belts and roads? How do we counter Russian influence through PMCs, private military contractors, and other that are causing instability and causing debt problems in African countries? So the goal in us to make success is to take all three of our energies and our other, as we used to call the little D's, and when it was used to be Center for Reconstruction, you know, commerce, treasury, justice, other partners. How do we capitalize and bring them into the game and build on what the big three D's can do?
Thank you. And you wanted to add something?
No. Yeah, building on what Joe just said, you know, the budget cycles are longer than we would like, right? I mean, that is the system in which we live. And so one of the challenges that we work on is how can we do the very best we can so that the resources and the programming are matching our analysis, our understanding of the needs, and to do so across agencies. That's point one. The second point is the coordination piece takes us time and effort. It makes us better, but it also requires additional resources. And we have put additional people in the field at our posts to help with that. And then the third point, I think you said something about a boat. I think I would refer to the U.S. government more like an aircraft carrier than a canoe.
Thank you. So, Brittany, you mentioned, I mean, in some of your examples, the importance of the local ownership. Locally driven solutions that we scale up to the GFA. And so my question then is, how do we ensure local buying to the GFA? And how do we, and this will be for you, Michelle, discussing how do you ensure the buying of other partners as we implement the GFA? But maybe, Brittany, will you start with how do we ensure local ownership and buying?
Yeah, maybe I'll answer the easier one first. It is interesting how it has been the, like, if you build it, they will come, as far as other donors. I am shocked by how often the first thing another donor says to me when they meet me is, you're so lucky to have GFA. Like, you're so lucky that your legislature has recognized the importance of this problem set when we think about foreign assistance, when we think about our foreign policy. Because we are currently, as far as I know, the only ones who have something like this that forces the US government and then has a Congress that is holding us accountable to those principles of GFA, of, you know, thinking about reforming the way that we do things. The donors actually have been very easy. In some cases, we actually are having to almost fight them off because they want to get involved in some of the amazing stuff we're doing. Like, specifically, I mean, IOM in West Africa, or you think about the partnerships we have with the, you know, folks in Haiti, or with Mozambique, or in Libya. We have European and actually non-Western donors in all of these places, and it's pretty amazing. So how are we staying true to sort of that local voice? I mean, this is like the age-old question of USAID. Like, it is hard to both listen to communities and have community-specific programming and do it on a wide scale. But there are, it's this creative monitoring and evaluation. It's this iterative questioning that we're doing. It's the way we are, again, getting it in the systems so that you can't just run a program. You have to actually talk to the local communities. Again, development people have known this for years, but we've struggled to do it beyond just the kind of like one-offs. Or like, you know, just in this country, it's going really well, but we haven't been able to do it systematically, and that's what GFA does. The other thing is like, I mean, I know I didn't talk about challenges. I think one of the things that was interesting about the response that we heard, you know, is nobody said we need billions of more dollars. I think it is, again, about the bureaucracy that we are trying to change. We don't necessarily need more money in this stuff. We just have to figure out, how do we get that money out faster? How do we get that money, like those conversations, that consultation that we're all doing, how do we move that a little bit faster? And we don't become the new impediment. We don't want to become the new sort of sludgy piece of all of this. We actually want to be the ones who are moving through all of that and finding ways to move our money faster. To, like, if there's anyone from Congress that's listening, how do we get less earmarks and no-year money? Like, how do we get multi-year budgets, right? Like, this is the stuff that makes very logical sense to anyone who's trying to think about how do you do, you know, foreign assistance on the development side. You better have multi-year funds that are, you know, don't have a million earmarks. Because if you want to switch with what's going on in the community, it's pretty hard to do, you know, an education program with health funds. You can do it. You can do DG programming with health funds, but it's really hard, and it requires a whole lot of that extra coordination and collaboration. So, thanks.
Michelle, back to you. Maybe how those principles are received in the UN and the multilateral organization, etc. How do we ensure? How do you ensure that the partners are on board with those?
So again, a big part of this, I think, is taking the U.S. experience with GFA and bringing it forward to how we show up in the conversations in the UN context. We are part of the Peace Building Commission, which is this group of countries that has this convening responsibility to look at what the UN can do in mediation and conflict prevention and peace building. We were part of the decision-making process in December of last year to ensure that the UN Peace Building Fund would have assessed funding from the member states, not just voluntary funding, to have a more sustainable and predictable source of funding. I love what you said about accountability, and that accountability for GFA is with our Congress. The accountability for everything that is done at the UN is with all of us, with the member states. So that accountability is part of what we're talking about as we move into 2025, this peace building architecture review. It's a very fancy name of looking at what has worked on the ground, what hasn't worked. There are many great examples of UN peace building, conflict prevention, lessons learned. We've had leaders from Liberia and Sierra Leone and Colombia share with the Peace Building Commission and with other member states. But, you know, the use of data, more rigorous analysis. And again, so many of you, and of course USIP and the Alliance as well, we need more data-driven decision-making, more data-driven UN peace-building. That's part of the accountability. But of course, it's not just about the resources. It's not just about the funding. It's about political will. It's about course correction and humility in the UN context as well. If something isn't working as well on the ground, to course correct and see how we can move ahead, that's humility, people-centered approach. It's increased national ownership, of course, of these conflict prevention strategies at that level. But I think everything that we are doing, state, DOD, USAID, we will be bringing forward to September 26th, the peace building ministerial during UN High Level Week in New York. We will carry it forward in the Summit for the Future. We're negotiating now something called the Pact of the Future, which has a big focus on peace building and conflict prevention, as well as new models of peacekeeping. And then we take it forward into 2025 in this PBAR, Peace Building Architecture Review.
Thanks, and we keep, and this, we are at PeaceCon, and so we have members here, and you keep referring to them. This is all about us, accountability, et cetera. So if I just want to dive a little bit more, what do you expect from members here in terms of supporting you in advancing this piece of, this framework and those principles? What do you expect from the members, from the civil societies here, members who are here? Anne?
Well, I want to continue the incredible partnership that we've had to date. I think this is about all of us. It is about building partnerships. It is about building ownership. We have a wide audience here, not only in the U.S., but I think globally. And so to your point about ownership, one of the things that we've been doing, which is really a terrific part of the intentionality of the GFA, is to build growing partnerships at the country level, where we're all working together across national governments, at the local government level, with UN partners who are there, with bilateral partners who are there, and all of you who may be present in any one or another of these places also has an important role to play as one of our interlocutors there. We are also working at the institutional level. And so we're talking about the UN and some of the changes that are taking place that we're talking about for High Level Week. We have been working very closely across the United Nations with our partners to ensure complementarity. And there's been a real eagerness and an openness to those conversations, whether that's IOM, which has already been mentioned, or UNDP, or the Peace Building Support Office. There are many parts of the UN that are relevant to these challenges, and I want you all to know that because you are also part of the community. And then if I may just build on something that Michelle said about the importance of data, if you'll give me a chance. One of the really interesting innovations that we've had a chance to be part of is to co-found a multi-donor data fund. It's called the Complex Risk Analytics Fund, or CRAFT, it's at the UN. And the important point about this is that we are partnering, another way to partner with others. We are providing some funds. There are a number of other donors to this effort as well. And then we're able to share the conflict-related, the crisis-related data that is tasked as a result of our working together. And we can innovate in the kind of data that we're looking for. So for example, we just approved a data call, a $3 million gender data call that will help us fill, as you all know better than anyone, really, really important gaps in these areas. So helping you understand what we are doing, I think, will also help us help you be the best possible partners for us. Thanks.
Michelle?
Yeah, thank you. For me, I'm coming to this right now as the Washington person who used to serve in New York as a New York person, but really it's 35 years in the field in so many of the countries in which the UN Peacebuilding Fund is working and now GFA is working. And I have to say, There is forward movement. It is daunting right now, as I said, 2 billion people in these conflict situations or post-conflict, immediate post-conflict situations. It is a complicated scenario out there with multiple crises around the world. Conflict, humanitarian crises, behind on the Sustainable Development Goals, and I think that focus right now on how all of this intersects: peace, development, humanitarian. It is much more targeted, I think, because we understand the urgency. When I say we, within the US government, and then what we bring to the UN. We talk a lot about peace building strategies. I think there's an impatience in so many countries, and including right here on this stage, that we need to make these peace building strategies real. These are people's lives. Peace, you know, the impact of peace building at the end of the day is the people and the communities on the ground. I think we've patted ourselves on the back far too often for, you know, a small success on the ground without really looking strategically at how we make it scalable. And that is why I think it is exciting, and I am also enthusiastic, Brittany, and we worked together on Haiti in our last tours. So there is room, I think, for optimism. These interlinkages, but we do need to remain ambitious, and we do need to remain focused to make progress.
Sure. Anything to add in terms of partnership and the role our members here can play in moving?
Yeah. No, thank you for reminding me of your original question, Joseph. So I also see, you know, across the span of the last couple of decades, it isn't just lip service saying, hey, we want more civil society participation, and we want more women or youth involved at the local level, but also bringing folks into the conversations in New York, for example. The interaction has been very deliberate, in fact, as we go into this Summit for the Future with a big meeting, for example, recently in Nairobi to bring in voices of civil society from around the world to make sure that it's not just member states talking to other member states, that there are more stakeholder views. It is our job to push to make GFA more effective in the countries and regions in which it works, but it's our job to take those lessons learned and then to, you know, push it forward, pay it forward at the level of all the countries in the world, you know, up at the UN. So again, as Anne and Brittany have mentioned, the partnerships, the data with UNDP, West Africa with IOM, but across the board, also with the UN Environmental Program, with UN Women, and so many more. So we are intertwined, but that's how we show up as the US, right? Bilaterally and multilaterally.
Brittany, anything to add?
I think it's really about the people in this room, right? When we talk about, you know, like, no one should misunderstand my enthusiasm for GFA is that we are done, because this is just the beginning. And I don't know what percent we are, but we have a long road ahead of us. And it actually, I mean, we have GFA because of some of you, like, and actually probably because of a lot of you who lobbied for this and wrote it and rewrote it and thought about it. And for that, giant thank you, and a little bit of, I'm sorry we weren't faster, because I think all of us up here wanted to be faster. But the good news is that it was deliberative enough that it is going to stick, but the reauthorization is coming up, and that means we need all of the brains in this room and all of the brains who care about this space to see, to help us identify where we need it to be even better. Where are we still missing? And how do we use all the people in here? People hear me say this all the time, but it's because it's so good, which is, right, none of us are as smart as all of us working together. And whatever is next for GFA, that means all of you. And so, like, the enthusiasm is, like, this is the first step. We have a long way to go, and I really hope that, like, all of you and all of our partners at the UN and everywhere will help us think about what we need to do next, because this has been such a big win so far.
That's a nice way to bring us almost to close here. Just as a closing remarks, any last thought you want the audience to take away from this conversation? I will start with Anne, and then we'll go just around the panel here.
Thanks. Well, this has been great. It's so much fun to be up here with my colleagues whom I'm working on this
important effort every single day, moving it forward, and as I hope we've conveyed to all of you, seeing some real progress, seeing some real early progress. Having said that, I'm going to quote the president, and he said in April of 2022, when we identified our priority partner countries, prevention is hard work, measured not in days and weeks, but in years and generations. So there's a lot of reason for optimism, but we also need to be patient, we need to be humble, we need to keep making the case for this effort. We need to keep working together, and we want to keep working together with all of you. You have brought so much to what we do already. We learn from you. We need to continue working together. We're really grateful for your support. We want to be more effective. We want to get more evidence. We want to learn, and we want to be able to demonstrate the value of our efforts as we go forward. So please, let's continue to engage. Thanks.
Joe?
Yes, thanks for having the DOD here with, you know, even though we're usually the Department of War / Department of Security, but, you know, really appreciate all the work that's getting done on this. You know, I would probably say that we should keep an eye on the 10-year plans. The 10-year plans provide us a framework and a goal to work towards and where we want to go. And we shouldn't really look at what's in those 10-year plans as a checklist. We should look at them as where we want to go in the future, sort of like a stretch goal, how we want to get things better in those select countries we have picked. We need to be flexible enough that we can make changes as we go along. And we need to be flexible enough that when partners want to bring stuff, no matter how small or insignificant it might be, but they want to contribute, we should bring them in. We should bring in partners that want to make things go better. I worked for General Zinni way back in US CENTCOM, and his view was any partner who wants to bring something to the cause for either stability, security cooperation, or to help should be invited into the table and have a seat at their table. And the same thing should be with how we look at how we bring partners into the Global Fragility Act. If you want to come, if you want to help, and you want to help make a difference, come join us and we'll make progress where we are in those GFA countries.
Thank you. Michelle?
I'll just bring it back to where we were up in New York last September. Of course, the focus was the Sustainable Development Goal Summit, and we talked a lot about how we were behind as the world in ensuring that food security and water security and global health security, education, that, you know, we have a 2030 agenda, we're moving forward, but we're behind. But we're not going to get there without conflict prevention, without peace building. So this investment in peace building, this investment in conflict prevention, really is how we tackle these transnational challenges, the climate crisis, water insecurity, food insecurity, the education and health challenges. We've got to tackle the conflict as well, and really happy to be up here to bring in, again, what we do with the GFA as the United States and how we bring that forward with every other country in the world to try to contribute lessons learned and try to push forward on this.
Thank you.
All right, it's hard to improve on all of that because I think like that's exactly right, like all of us together. So a giant thank you to everyone who's been working on this. And I think the reminder of that, right, hard stuff is hard, and we did turn the aircraft carrier, and we did move a mountain, and we are doing it. So we can't give up on GFA, on peacekeeping, even though it you look at the world and it feels pretty overwhelming, but that we cannot give up, and really this idea of that we are the ones that we've been waiting for. So let's do this.
Thank you. Please join me to thank our panelists. Now it's my pleasure to invite Ambassador Moose for the closing remarks.
Thank you. Thanks, Sonny. So as we used to say at the UN, everything has been said, but not everybody has said it. And I don't know, frankly, that I can add anything to this wonderful, rich discussion we've just had here in the panel. I want to thank the panelists. I want to thank especially my good friend and colleague, Dr. Sani. You know why we value him so much here at the Institute, so thanks. But let me begin where Brittany left off, which is, as I said this morning, we should not undervalue this achievement that we, this community, was able to accomplish in getting the Congress to enact a Global Fragility Act on a bipartisan basis, which showed recognition of the importance of the need for precisely this kind of a paradigm, this kind of a mechanism to enable us to get ahead of that cycle of conflict. It was a breakthrough. Yes, it was. It was turning the aircraft carrier. And it has attracted, as we know, interest from across the community, including those governments elsewhere that wish they had a similar kind of mechanism. So let's start by recognizing just how important this instrumentality is, this whole shift in the way we think. We've been talking about whole of government efforts for years. Actually, the DOD has been better at implementing these than we have, and with the support of its congressional constituencies. So that's point number one. But the other reality, and certainly that was reflected in the conversation here today as well, is that it is new, and yes, it is fragile, and it's hard. It's hard to take all those levers of government and try to figure out how you work them in coordination so that they work together. So let's not be discouraged by that. I mean, those are growing pains. They're inevitable. They're necessary growing pains, which means that we as a community need to double down in supporting this concept so that it doesn't sort of fall off the table and doesn't get lost along the way. We need to continually remind people of what this concept brings to our ability to deal with the realities of conflict around the world. So not a reason to be discouraged. As I said this morning as well, though, it is not a tool that is adaptable to every conflict situation around the world. And we need to keep that in mind. We can't overpromise. We can't say this is something that we can apply, frankly, in not just fragile places, but I would say failed places, such as Libya or Haiti. Which is not to say that we give up on those places. We don't have that luxury. It's simply to say that this is not the tool for that problem. And we need to look at other responses, other mechanisms for dealing with those real challenges with real consequences and real costs to the people who are living through them. So we need to nurture this tool to make sure what we need most and above all is to ensure that it succeeds, to demonstrate the proof of concept so that people will, in fact, continue to endorse and support it and fund it. We've talked about the effort this represents to bring together the whole of our government. But again, and Michelle spoke to this repeatedly, the need to recognize that we are not the only government out there, nor are we the only multi-governmental, intergovernmental entity that is relevant to this concept in this conversation. And so part of this is a bit, and maybe we've already done this as well, is demonstrating to others the value of this mechanism, the value of this concept. Inviting others to participate. Brittany, you said something that troubled me a little bit when you said you were sort of pushing people away. No, we shouldn't be pushing people away, Joe. We should be inviting them in, obviously, in a structured, coordinated way. But if they have something to bring to the table, and ours is the mechanism of choice for doing it, I'm all for it, I'm all in. And last but not least, for our community. I mean, I would hope that every organization in this room would be looking at that agenda on fragility and saying, how can my organization contribute to what's happening in coastal West Africa, or in Mozambique, or elsewhere around the world? What assets, what experience, what relationships do we have that would reinforce, that would contribute to the goals that we are trying to achieve in these places? And I guess the last thing I would say, I mean, I think this is a terrific panel on which to conclude this first day of the conference, and I hope what it does is inform the conversations you all will be having for the next 2 days. I would just remind, though, that this is, the whole concept here was about fragility. The Global Fragility Act is not a development program. It's not a military assistance program. It is, first and foremost, about how we make societies more resilient to the kinds of forces that we know can contribute to conflict. Now, having said that, I also recognize that that only succeeds to the extent that we connect that agenda to the other agendas that we're talking about, notably to the development agenda. And one of the most important gaps, one of the major gaps that we still have in the peacebuilding field is the connection between what we are doing to make societies more resilient socially and politically, and our ability to enable those societies to deliver to their citizens. We are not living up to the necessity and the expectation that we are helping these governments and societies deliver for their people. We were to have had here on Thursday a gathering of the World Bank, and several of the folks here were going to be participating in that to talk about their fragility program. And it would have been an opportunity, Liz, for us to reinforce that message with them, because they're necessarily part of that conversation. So again, to the point, we need to continue to make the case for the value of this, not only amongst ourselves, with our immediate partners in the government, but with all the other institutions whose contributions will be critical to the success of this initiative. So with that, I again thank our panelists. I thank you all for spending a long afternoon here. And I certainly encourage you to go forth and take all of the wisdom that we have, that has been imparted to us today, and weave that into the conversations that you will be having over the next 2 days. Wish you all the success. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.